juncture of the book, puts us in the third and final cycle. This one, once again, a little bit heavier on judgment, though the salvation oracle at the end is a little bit longer than it was in the first cycle, more than two verses, and is just a really stunning and beautiful end as Micah ends by reflecting on the mercy of God, the forgiveness of God. So I look forward to kind of contemplating that with you today. Beginning in chapter 6, we're just going to jump right in. As we look here, chapter 6 starts with another one of those familiar, now beginning to be more and more familiar, sorts of writings in the Minor Prophet, and that is that there's sort of this courtroom, a covenant lawsuit is leveled once again against Israel. And this one, probably if you were teaching a class on the Minor Prophets and we're giving an example of a covenant lawsuit, this is one of the premier ones. There's all of the characters in the courtroom are set forth. You can see a lot of it laid out very clearly. So there's these charges that are brought forth, and then it ends with this requirement, like, what would you have us to do? The defendant responds, and God gives his answer. So as we begin to look at this, let's just kind of identify the characters. Obviously, God is going to be the plaintiff or the accuser, the one bringing the charge. But then one of the kind of cool poetic things that Micah does is he gives us a jury as well. So we have the mountains that are the jury. He says, plead your case before the mountains, to the defendant, right? Say why you're not guilty. Let the hills hear your voice. And then hear, O you mountains, the Lord's complaint, and you strong foundations of the earth. So there's a few other times that this sort of an inanimate object is used as a jury. And one of the most interesting is at the end of Joshua, where he's calling the people back to covenant faithfulness. And he calls on the stones as the jury. And the reason he gives is because they heard the law. They heard the covenant. So that sort of picture is kind of cool here. As God calls on the mountains to be the jury, he's like, you're objective. And you've heard this law before, right? The mountains are the place where the law was given. The strong foundations of the earth is sort of Jonah language. If you remember the song of Jonah in chapter 2, when he's descending, right? He's thinking he's dying. And the ends of the earth, the strong foundations, are to where he sinks. So the mountains from their peaks all the way to their very bases in the oceans are the jury to which God appeals here, or he levels out these charges. So there's our jury. The defendant, of course, is Israel. Plaintiff is God, and he opens that up in verse 2. The Lord has a complaint against his people, and he will contend with Israel. So there they are identified. Now, you might expect that the next thing that happens is all the accusations are leveled. But God does one other thing in the court setting first, and that's verses 3 through 5. And he essentially declares his innocence in their sin. Oh, my people, what have I done to you? How have I wearied you? Testify against me. So as I'm bringing these charges, if there's any reason you would have, any provocation that I have given you that caused you to sin, say it. Go ahead, bring it before the mountains. Let them hear you. And it isn't anything, of course. And God gives his explanation for that. He's like, look, I'm completely innocent. Not only have I not brought you down, that would be this wearied image. In fact, I brought you up. I've done nothing but good to you as my people. And here's some examples. I brought you up from the land of Egypt. I redeemed you from the house of bondage. I sent before you Moses, Aaron, and Miriam. So he's given them a freedom, and he's given them leadership. He's done nothing but bless them. So what God's doing is not only declaring his innocence, but also his righteousness, and he'll state that explicitly at the end of verse 5. So there's freedom that he's given them, going back to what some commentators, I like the phrase, they said the Exodus theology. So he appeals to Exodus theology here. He brought them out of their captivity from the house of bondage. And then he gave them wise leaders, Moses, Aaron, Miriam, a variety of people. And you could go on beyond there in redemptive history, or Israel's history, seeing how God is faithful to them. And he gives them a few other examples, like Numbers 22 through 24. Well, remember, I'm going to bring another evidence before the court, before the mountains. Mountains, hear me. Remember what Balak, king of Moab, counseled, and what Balaam, the son of Beor, answered him? If you remember back from our study in Peter, in Jude, this Balak and Balaam situation was an interesting one. It's quite lengthy in the Old Testament, but Balaam's this false prophet, but a very premier one, a highly esteemed and respected prophet. And Balak, king of Moab, is trying to get him to pronounce a curse on God's people. So remember what Balak, king of Moab, wanted? He wanted a curse. And what happened? Blessing. When Balaam opened his mouth, blessing came out. So look what I did for you. I reversed the evil of your enemies into a blessing. I've always been for you. From the acacia grove to Gilgal, the acacia grove, or Shittim, is the easternmost, the final stop before the Jordan River. And then Gilgal is the first stop on the western border of the Jordan. So he's saying, look at how I brought you across the Jordan and into the land. It's the beginning of the conquest, right? I brought you over here. So in every way, I've been faithful to you. There's no spot on my character. There's no provocation. I've been a good father. I didn't provoke you to wrath. What have I done? How have I wearied you? Testify against me. Because if you think about all these activities, all you're going to learn is that I have been righteous. This is the first evidence that he brings before the court. The good king has been completely faithful. So the defendant responds, and this is Israel's voice. Okay? So the I is Zion or Jerusalem, the people of Israel. With what shall I come before the Lord? What do you want? What can I bring you, accuser? How should I bow myself before the high God? Shall I come before him? Here's some options. Shall I come before him with burnt offerings, like a year-old calf? Shall I come before him, or will the Lord be pleased with thousands of rams? How about with 10,000 rivers of oil? I'll give one further. Shall I give my firstborn for my transgression, the fruit of my body for the sin of my soul? What do you want? What do I have to bring you? With what can I come before you? What can I put in my hands and walk before you with that you will be done, that this court will cease to be in session? And I think that's revealing of their error, is that they're viewing, what can I do? With what can I bring? What fits in my hand? And they get quite extreme, right? From something simple, a burnt offering, something normal, all the way to, okay, thousands of rams, which would not have been normative for an individual Israelite. And in the high celebrations or like the consecration of the temple, there would have been thousands of offerings, but that's not normal. The Lord be pleased with thousands or 10,000 rivers of oil, not just the bottles of oil, but rivers of oil. So it's just as big and grand as it gets, or greatest of them all, my kid. Do you want me to sacrifice my firstborn son for my sin? What can I put in my hand physically to hand to the high God? And the answer is nothing. There is nothing that fits in your hand that you could bring to the Most High God that undoes the offense of sin. And this is their error, right? That they're resting in the rituals. It wasn't stuff that God desired. But he wants, verse 8, And this is probably the premier verse of Micah, the most well-known verse. He says, "He's shown you what is good, O man. And what does the Lord require of you?" So here's the preface to the answer. You should already know. You should already know that it's not a sacrifice. What you should know is this. He wants you to do justly, love mercy, walk humbly with your God. These are the three, this triad, poetic summation, really, of the intent of the law. Now, when it says, "He's shown you, O man, what is good, what does the Lord require of you?" When did he show them? When has he given this in, as an example? And I'd just like to read a text that would have been familiar to them, Deuteronomy 10, verses 12 and 13. The essence of the law. He says, "Oh, now, O Israel, what does the Lord God require of you but to fear the Lord? Fear the Lord your God, to walk in all his ways, to love him, to serve the Lord your God with all your heart and with all your soul, and to keep the commandments of the Lord and his statutes, which I have commanded you today for your good." So there is one example of several in the giving of the law, where God describes that his intent is something that's internal rather than something that's external. You can't put this in your hand. You can't bring it before the king. Instead, it's something that's inside of you and that shows itself by your activities, by your habit of life, by your obedience. So the three things are justice, mercy, and walking humbly with your God. So justice, we've talked much about this. It's a theme of the minor prophets, but it is truth in action. It is that which is righteous. It's something that orders every aspect of the human existence. It's intended to create an ordered society, morally, religiously, spiritually, politically, socially, economically, in every way. It sets in place a right society as God has designed. And they needed to embody this personally, and not just bark out orders of justice or say maybe what God has said or give this half-hearted or self-serving attempt at justice. That wasn't it. No, that would be injustice. Right? I would be missing the point if that was the end result. So he's saying, no, it's something that's inside of you. You embody it personally. Do justice. And that's described. Right, throughout the law, how we would do that. Here's the system that you can follow. But do justice. And then love mercy, or embrace chesed, the loyal love of God. Your affections are intended to respond to the love of God as its intent is to change, once again, the inside of you. So love that which is merciful. Love the faithfulness of God. Embody it. Practice it. And then he says, I think kind of in summary, actually, of the previous two, rather than something that's distinct from them, is he says, walk humbly with your God. And this is actually not the normal word for humble in the Old Testament. It might not be the best translation of this word. Probably better rendered, walk carefully. Walk, maybe a New Testament word would be circumspectly. Right? Walk carefully. Be intentional and cautious in living the way that your God wants you to, that he's described for you, that he's called you to, commanded you to. Be very careful that you do that, which would include not misorienting or reordering what a worship what true worship is. Here, that's what he's kind of trying to do, is undo their misunderstanding of worship. It's not just that which is physical in your hand, the ritual, but it is the nature of one's heart. So, there's the response then of the defendant in the courtroom. Well, what do you want me to do? What would make this right? What can I bring you? And he responds, bring me nothing. be true to what I've called you to do. You know, I've already asked you. I asked you ages ago in the old covenant. And so then there's, in one way, the section breaks there. It is a literal, a literary break, but the ideas continue because there's further charges that are leveled. But he's just poetically seated. Now the Lord's voice cries to the city, right? He's not, it's not the courtroom setting poetically, but he's continuing these ideas. And there's about to be a verdict as well. So I think we'd do well or be safe in continuing in this accusation and judge idea here. So the Lord's voice cries to the city, wisdom shall see your name, or probably better, whoever hears and fears has wisdom. Whoever observes you will be wise. Hear the rod, or hear the discipline. Hear what I'm about to do. Who has appointed it? Well, God has. Hear what God is about to do because of your sin. So see the fruit of your sin. Are there yet the treasures of wickedness in the house of the wicked? Yes. And the short measure, that is an abomination? Yes. Shall I count pure those with the wicked scales and with a bag of deceitful weights? No. For her rich men are full of violence. Her inhabitants have spoken lies. Their tongue is deceitful in their mouth. So the charges that he levels toward them are kind of economic. In the civil realm, they're being unfair. So in verse 10, there's gain, there's treasure that has been gained by means of wickedness. There's our very Proverbs image, the band of fools that has laid wait, and now they steal, they get a quick gain. Perhaps is a good example of that happening. And the short measure that is an abomination, so the falsely weighted scales, right? You say you're selling a pound, but you're only selling 3/4 of a pound. You're skimming off the top and you're getting more money. He's like, should I say that those people are pure? Should I just overlook that? Mountains, what do you think? Jury, what do you think? You know, no, I can't overlook that. I am the God of justice. I desire justice. I desire mercy. I desire people to walk circumspectly, to be careful. So here's what's true. Here's the accusation. The rich men, full of violence. The inhabitants, lies. Their tongue, deceit. So there, once again, you kind of have the leader, evidence at the beginning, the rich men, with a trickle-down effect to the inhabitants. And we'll see that one other time later tonight in chapter 7. So there's the accusation, and we come across the sentence then, beginning in verse 13. Therefore, here's what I'm going to do. Judge is speaking. I will also make you sick by striking you, by making you desolate because of your sins. You shall eat, but not be satisfied. Hunger shall be in your midst. You may carry some away, but shall not save them. And what you rescue, I will give over to the sword. You shall sow, but not reap. You shall tread the olives, but not anoint yourselves with oil. Make sweet wine, but not drink wine. So here what we have are a series of 5 futility curses, is what they're called. Futility curse. And that is these described. You will eat, but not be satisfied. Hunger will be in your midst. That's number one. You will carry some away, but shall not save them. And further description, what you rescue, I will give over to the sword. That's number 2. Sow, but not reap. Number 3. Tread the olives, not anoint yourself. Number 4, make wine, but not drink wine. And you can feel the name, the futility curse, in itself carries the emotion of what's happening here. There's an emptiness about all their laboring. There's an emptiness to all the effort that they're pouring into, for example, a harvest in verse 15. That we put all this work into sowing, and we tended, and we weeded, and we watered, and we did all of this stuff, and then we get nothing from it. But then, look, there's something from it, the olives. Okay, so we tread those, and we work, and we actually seek to preserve that which has come forward from this poor harvest. And even with it, we don't get to use it. We don't get to anoint ourselves with oil. There's no joy from it. And then there's even the further, right? So this says you don't reap, but then there's something that they reaped. And then they move towards the preservation, but then they don't get to enjoy it. There's no final product. And then we have a final product, wine. You actually get to make sweet wine, but now you don't get to drink it. There's no warmth, no joy, no mirth, no celebration, no commemoration, no nothing. None of the high points, none of the satisfaction, only the labor, only the output. So it's like you get home at the end of a full day of work, and you don't get paid. And in fact, nothing's good. You're tired, you're sore, and let's say, or maybe there's the guy that's working out, time and time again, working out. Nothing, no evidence of it. You're cursed by as much as you work out, and you will always work out, you will never look any better, feel any better. It's horrible, right? It's like the hamster wheel idea from Ecclesiastes. We're just constantly doing, and nothing's happening. The first ones, so that was kind of verse 15, previous to that, verse 14, is that there's an emptiness in their stomach. You can eat all you want, but there's not like that full feeling. You're just empty chamber, constantly filling, and it doesn't satisfy. And then the second one is just carrying away, but won't save them. It's like if you, let's say, on a monthly basis, you put aside 10% of your income, and you're saving it away, but then it disappears. It's gone. You don't get the 10% that you've been saving away, and you don't get to enjoy it later. You don't get it then, you don't get it later. Nothing of the things that you saved, like the grain maybe that Joseph saved for Egypt. If he had saved for 7 years, but then there was a great fire on the 7th year before everything went bad, and all the grain's gone. That's the idea. Futility curse. That's what Israel is receiving for their sins. Why has been explicitly stated because of the sins. So let's talk about that a little bit more. He says, for the statutes of Omri are kept, and the works of Ahab's house are done. So these were two of the northern kings that were both incredibly, them and Ahab's wife as well, were incredibly wicked and introduced great paganism into Israel, northern Israel. And the problem now with Judah is they're following, they're patterning their worship, their activity after the fallen northern kingdom. So you walk in their councils. That's why I will make you a desolation and your inhabitants a hissing. Therefore you shall bear the reproach of my people. So probably the overall idea is scorn. Mocking, being made fun of, like being maybe this smaller kid in elementary who gets, he's like surrounded by the big bullies and they're just kicking him and making fun of him and, you know, breaking his glasses and all these things. It's just, they're the laughing stock of the people. Keep that in mind for later as well. The image will eventually be reversed. Israel's the laughing stock. So that brings us to the end of this first big movement. All of 16 is kind of the courtroom setting, but probably one of the most vivid and detailed of all of them that we've come across so far. So Micah responds, beginning of chapter 7, before we move to salvation, with a personal lament. This is the lament of the prophet. Woe is me. And here's his song. And it's a bit like some of the prophets who predated him. It's a lament of isolation, loneliness, he's the only one. There are no other righteous people. So just kind of hear his cry here. I'm like those who gather summer fruit. Too late, summer fruit. Like those who glean vintage grapes. There's no cluster to eat of the first ripe fruit, which my soul desires. So the very thing that he's longing for, which is righteousness in the land, righteous companions, other faithful prophets, other faithful people, and particularly faithful leadership. He wants faithful leadership. And here's probably the other place that we have the trickle-down effect clearly described. I mean, he's not saying that there isn't a soul left, but that's sure how it looks. And there's not a soul of leadership left, and that has had a trickle-down effect in the people. Many of the people have followed suit. They're wicked. They're evil as well. He's like someone who walks out too late in the harvest, goes into the vineyard, and all of the grapes that he's tasting are just like warm, wrinkled, soggy. Like, it's not good. It's disgusting, right? It's not like what his soul desires, that like really juicy, ripe, sweet grape. It's very different than that. It's long past that. Israel is expired, you might say. That's the poetry of it, but then he states it in real terms in verse 2. The faithful man has perished. There is no one upright among men. They all lie in wait for blood. Every man hunts his brother with a net. Why? That they may successfully do evil with both hands. The prince asks for gifts, the judge seeks the bribe, great man utters evil desire. So there again is our leadership particularly identified, and is good evidence that that's the main target of Micah's lamentation. He's not saying there's not a good poor man, he's saying there's not a good rich one. He's not saying there's not a good common man, he's saying there's no good leader. None of the princes, which is essential for a society that's seeking to live in the justice of God system. So the faithful man perished. Isaiah brings both of these ideas together as well. No surprise there, these two being contemporaries and Isaiah being the much lengthier prophet. Isaiah 5:7, he says, "For the vineyard of the Lord of hosts is the house of Israel, and the men of Judah are his pleasant plant. He looked for justice, but behold, oppression. For righteousness, but behold, a cry for help." So he goes to the vineyard and finds the opposite. Everything's upside down. None of the rulers are righteous. That verse 3 is pretty condemning as well. That they may successfully do evil with both hands. That's an image. Successfully is the idea of skillful. It's actually not unrelated to the idea of wisdom. Someone that's an expert in their field. And they are skillfully with two hands, not just one, not like a good hand and a bad hand. Like, as much as they can, they're taking advantage of the system. They're good at it, and they pride themselves in it. Then there's that threefold, you know, all the leaders, prince, judge, great man, all of them. In fact, all of them together. They're a band of evildoers who are skillful in their carving up of the people. Goes back to the soup image that Micah used before. Continues condemnation through 4, and then he kind of breaks into another idea. So the best of them, the best of the leaders, briar, thorn. The most upright, sharper than a thorn hedge. They all do what? They all tear. They all grab. They all rip flesh. That's what they do. Even as good as they get, they're awful. So here's the conclusion of the lament, but the conclusion of that initial section. He says, the day of judgment is coming to these wicked thorns. The day of your watchmen and your punishment comes, now shall be their perplexity. And there's a few different ways in which you could read that. But any way you read it, you end with the idea the judgment has arrived. The time has come for God to make things right. So his conclusion is 5 through 7, and it's a sort of a statement of personal resolve. What's he going to do about this? How should he and perhaps the other faithful people respond? Well, you can't trust people. He says, don't trust in a friend. Don't put your confidence in a companion. Guard the doors of your mouth from her who lies in your bosom. For son dishonors father, daughter rises against mother, daughter-in-law against her mother-in-law. A man's enemies are the men of his own household. So no one, you can't trust anyone. In fact, the closer they are to you, perhaps the more dangerous they are. Because all of them have twisted tongues and these evil desires, and they're seeking bribes, and they're trying to skillfully do evil with both hands. So no one is trustworthy. He, again, is describing this complete aloneness that he's experiencing. So you can't rest in them. You can't put your confidence, put your trust in them. Very Psalm 62, right? Don't rest here. For God alone my soul waits in silence. Even so far as to say, you know, friend, companion, wife, son, daughter, daughter-in-law, those in your house. There's no relationship too close here for the spread of the evil. So his conclusion to look to the Lord. Therefore, because of this resolve, I am going to look to, which is also trust and put my confidence in the Lord. I will wait for the God of my salvation. And probably because of last week, that sounds a little bit, I mean, that God of my salvation is the same phrase that Mary uses. It's a humble statement, a statement of acknowledgement of your need. And he ultimately is believing that he will have hope because the ear of God will condescend to hear him, to respond to him. And I think that there's also a note here of condemnation about the watchmen previously, perhaps the leaders, prophets, false prophets, right? The prophets that were taking money, giving a good word to those who put food in their mouth, and a word of judgment to those who didn't. And he's saying, what does the watchman do? The watchman looks. The watchman waits. So he's sort of committing to faithfulness and the responsibility that God has given to him. Even if everyone else abandons their post, he will not abandon his. He's going to continue in fidelity to the God of faithfulness. That's the end of the judgment. So from verse 8 to verse 20, it's, again, one big section, but we're going to break it into four smaller ones, partially for the sake of the page and partially because there are subcategories of ideas. But the judgment ends with the lawsuit and the lamentation, those two ideas. So the salvation oracle begins in a very interesting way, in a corporate psalm of trust. So there are personal pronouns that are used, Oliver, but it's a plural feminine, they're plural feminine pronouns. So the idea is that Zion is speaking here, Jerusalem, the city, is speaking here. And it's kind of interesting. It doesn't maybe make sense on its face because a psalm of trust right now, I mean, trust is, that part makes sense because the psalms of trust are psalms of light in dark places. They're psalms of resolve when things look very difficult. It's that there will be light at the end of the tunnel sort of an idea. And that makes sense. But some of the things he says later on are almost baffling compared to chapter 6 that we just read. So let's read 8 through 10. Here's the corporate psalm. Don't rejoice over me, my enemy. When I fall, I will arise. When I sit in darkness, the Lord will be a light to me. I will bear the indignation of the Lord because I've sinned against him. Well, that's good. That's right. I understand that. Until he pleads my case and executes justice for me, he will bring me forth to the light. I will see his righteousness. Then, when that happens, she who is my enemy will see. And shame will cover her who said to me, where is the Lord your God? My eyes will see her. Now she will be trampled down like mud in the streets. This is a very interesting psalm. Again, trust, that's good. It's good. It's a light in a dark place. And that's what they're experiencing is, the futility curses. That's where they're at the dawn of darkness is where they're at. And they know that they're going to bear the indignation of the Lord. So why is it? Why is it that they tell their enemies not to rejoice? Well, that does kind of remind us of chapter 1, verse 10, when at the beginning of that very fascinating, like, word poem, full of the names of cities and things, he began with, tell it not in Gath, weep not at all in Beth Aphra. And that was because, that was a harkening back to the day that Saul and Jonathan died. And David said, tell it not in Gath, or don't let our enemies see it. Don't let them know about it. Why? Because they will turn it into a day of rejoicing over us. So he's warning the enemies at the beginning of this song, these nations that are about to come in conquest. He's like, don't rejoice over us. Even though we're trampled, we're not dead. Even though it's dark, it's not dark enough. Like, there will be light. In fact, at the end of the day, you're going to be trampled in the streets. Right? Now she will be trampled down like mud in the streets. So this is going to flip on you. So don't be too excited. Now, what is it that gives them reason to believe that? How can they say after chapter 6, until he pleads my case and executes justice for me, he just did. He pled against you. Your case doesn't look good. Your case is condemnation. And he executes justice for me? Well, justice for you is the futility curses. Justice for you is death. How do you sing this psalm to your enemies when you know that he's the one that sent them? He'll bring me forth to the light. I'll see his righteousness. You hate his righteousness. The reason that they're able to sing something like this is are the promises of God that are previous to them in the book. If you remember last week, chapters 3, 4, and 5. And the promise that immediately follows it in the text. So, glance with me at verses 11 and 12. This is God's promise, following the Psalm of Trust, of the restoration of Zion. So Zion sang, and now Zion is restored. In the day when your walls are to be built. In that day, the decree, or even the boundaries, the fences, go far and wide, right? They expand. In that day, they shall come to you. I believe that's at least they is the exiles are returning, and likely the inclusion of other proselytes, essentially. They shall come to you from where? Well, they come to you from Assyria and the fortified cities, from the fortress to the river, from sea to sea, and mountain to mountain. They come from all over the place. And the fortified cities and fortress, those are, the words are also possibly Egyptian cities. So you may have this nation's idea from Assyria to Egypt, into the river, and that's actually the word Euphrates. That might be right on the line. The word Euphrates. So from all over these places, and then he goes from actual national boundaries to, like, geographical ideas, like, from the sea to the sea, and from the mountain to the mountain, from all over everywhere, there's all of these people. They come to you. Who is you? You is Zion. They come to Zion. And yet, outside of Zion, what's happening? The land, the people, the earth is the word. The earth is still desolate. Why? Because of those who dwell in it, because of the other inhabitants of Assyria, because of the inhabitants of Egypt, all of these wicked people, because of their sin. So once again, sin produces desolation. Sin produces futility curses. And now it's a beginning in the imagery to be reversed, where you now have God blessing his people, the restoration of Zion, the expansion of her boundaries, and all these people coming into it. And Zion is wonderful. It's like this oasis. And outside of her, emptiness, futility curse, desolation, consequence for sin because of the fruit of their deeds. So you could have an anti-Micah speaking verse, the beginning of Micah's lament in verse 1 about the nations in 13, if that makes sense. So someone could walk outside of Zion in that day and say, man, I'm like those who gather summer fruits, but there's nothing here. There's no cluster of the first ripe fruit which my soul desires. There's no good thing outside of Zion. There's a reversal there. An island of blessing and a sea of desolation. So their hope, their psalm of trust, is the fruit of God's promise of restoration to them. From verses 14 down through 17, we have a prayer followed by an answer. So 14 is the initial prayer, and then 15 is God's answer, and 16 and 17 is sort of the response, I suppose, or the reaction to God's answer. So let's look at that. He says, shepherd, this is Micah, like a prayer from the prophet to God for his people. Shepherd your people with your staff, the flock of your heritage. So this is who they are. And this is where they are. This is their affliction. This is why they need help. They dwell solitarily in a woodland in the midst of Carmel. The Hebrew is tricky on particularly the second part. But I think that the idea is actually a negative idea rather than a positive one. It's the thicket. They dwell in the woodland, in the thicket, outside of their land. They're not where they were supposed to be. They need shepherded. The flock of God needs their shepherd king to come and to lead them, to be led with his staff. And to feed them, right? Let them feed back where they were before. Right? Take them to Bashan and Gilead, these areas of great fertility, as in the days of old. Restore us back to the former glories, as you promised. Establish the kingdom of the shepherd king, David, right? So that's his prayer. Will you do that? Will you accept your inheritance? Will you receive us, feed us, guide us? And God says, yes, I will. Verse 15, as in the days when you came out of the land of Egypt, I will show them wonders. So once again, we have Exodus theology. And the idea is, this is a very common Old Testament concept. Look back. Remember what I did. I will do it again. Remember Egypt. Remember how lost you were, how broken you were, how afflicted you were, how unable you were to get out. Right? Bondage. The house of bondage is where you lived in the land of Egypt. And I freed you from it. I redeemed you. I brought you out. And I'll do that again. In fact, the wonders that I show, like the plagues, I'll bring plagues again. I will show the nations what I'm capable of. And I'll deliver you. So here's Micah's response to that. Right? What a word of comfort from the Lord to receive this answer. Right? It will be, okay, I will restore you. So he says, okay, so the nations, they're going to see. And they're going to be embarrassed. They're going to be ashamed of all their strength, right? The biggest guy on the block. And then Goliath shows up. And you're like, oh, yeah, maybe I'm not as big as I thought I was, right? They're
embarrassed at what they thought was once a mighty show of force. And then they put their hand over their mouth, and their ears are deaf. They can't hear. Then they lick the dust as a serpent. They crawl from their holes like snakes of the earth. And they shall be afraid of the Lord our God and shall fear because of you. Okay, so this is one of two things. This is either the confrontation of God to the nations and their subsequent humility, or it's the confrontation of God to the nations and their subsequent rebellion. And I believe, contextually, it's probably the second one, that's a statement of their rebellion. In one way, because God has described them as, he compared them in his answer to Exodus, to Egypt. And Egypt is an object of destruction. They're destroyed. And then part of the reason for the confusion is this, the hand over the mouth and the ears shall be deaf, is that that they're like in awe of him in a humble way. And then they're afraid and they fear. Is that like a good fear of God? And in this case, I don't believe that it is. I believe he's striking terror into them. He's absolutely bringing them low. He's exposing them, showing them for who they are. This is the deliverance of God's people, which necessarily means the judgment of God's enemies. And then the comparison to Genesis 3:14, that God describes them with the very curse that he gave to the serpent. This is what you're going to be. He's giving them a curse. So that's what he's bringing. The nation shall see and be ashamed. They're going to lick the dust like a serpent. They'll crawl from their holes like snakes of the earth. This is not a good day. This is a day of a great fall rather than great reconciliation, I think, as it concerns the nations. So those that were blessed, I think, are already, as far as Micah is concerned, are already in the walls of Zion, based on the previous promise of God's restoration in verse 11 through 13. So then, the prayer, God's response, and then the following response, I suppose, of Micah, that the nations are going to be brought very low in similar fashion to the way that the serpent was brought low when his sin was exposed. Okay, then we come to the final section, 18 through 20. And this is another psalm, like it ends with a psalm. And it is beautiful. Part of this is probably familiar to you if you don't already know it well, but it's a psalm of praise. He says, "Who is a God like you, pardoning iniquity, passing over the transgression of the remnant of his heritage? He doesn't retain his anger forever. Because he delights in mercy, he will again have compassion on us and will subdue our iniquities. He will cast all our sins into the depths of the sea. You will give truth to Jacob and mercy to Abraham, which you have sworn to our fathers from days of old." So there's a few things that are going on here. One of them is to note the incomparability. Better not talk while I try and spell that one. The incomparability of God to anyone else. Who's like him? Well, the answer is no one. There's no one at all. No God is like this, who pardons iniquity. So there's a few characteristics that are given here. Forgiving love. That's who you are. That's not like other gods. Not in this way. Pardoning iniquity, passing over transgression. He describes this in four different ways. Pardoning, passing over, subduing, casting out. Followed right by iniquity, transgression of the remnant of his heritage, iniquities, sins. And they're theirs, right? Our iniquities, our sins, the transgression of the remnant of his heritage, the sins of the people who are his. Those are the sins he pardons, he passes over, he subdues. And the idea of subdues is the right word, but it doesn't maybe give us the punch. Like, he tramples them. He brings the iniquities under his feet. and then he cast them into the sea. They are no more. They are annihilated, the sins. They're completely gone. So he's a God of incomparable forgiving love. He's also a God, and this, in one way, this is saying the same thing, but he has this redeeming power. But he delights in mercy. He delights in restoration. And this 19 is actually a pair. This idea that the emotion of God perhaps is described here, this compassion, this motherly, tender look upon her child. She wants good for him. After all, this is his heritage. This is his inheritance. These are the people that Father has given into his hand. So he looks upon them and with compassion, but simultaneously, aren't they full of sin? So what do you have to do? Trample the sin in order to demonstrate compassion on the one that you've inherited. You can't have one without the other. And so in his forgiving love and his redeeming power, he tears away the sin and takes care of it himself. And then finally, there's the perpetual loyalty. That's communicated in both of these ideas. So the emet to Jacob and the chesed to Abram. The fact that he is a God who doesn't move. When he gives his word, he stays. You can trust it. He is the true arrow, the one that's unbending, unwavering. And when he sends it, it's going to land. It's going to hit its mark. That's his character. And that's tied to his mercy. That's tied to the promise he made, his covenant to them. So when you marry these two, you're left with an immovable force. The God of Abram, Isaac, and Jacob, he can't remove himself from his promise. He's going to do it. He's going to accomplish it. That's why Israel can sing, until he pleads my case and executes justice for me. He will bring me forth in the light. I will see his righteousness. It's because of who he is. The fact that from the olden days, we saw that last week. Yet one shall come forth to me, the one to be ruler in Israel, whose goings forth are from of old, from everlasting, from this ancient promise of the bloodline of Abram and David, will arise the ruler who will deliver you from yourself. He will deliver you from your iniquities that have subdued you. He will subdue in his compassion. He will again show mercy to you because he delights in it. That's who he is. And that's the conclusion of Micah, is this beautiful song. He ends this really on this wonderfully high note of reflection on the incomparable character of the God who makes promises to his fathers. But that brings us to the end of Micah. If you have any comments, questions, we can open it up maybe for a few minutes, and then we'll close in prayer.